Matthew chapter 23, we're going to begin our reading at verse 1, reading from the New King James Version. Read down to verse 6 before we begin our comments, where we ended last Wednesday evening, if I remember correctly. Remember, the things that are taking place in this chapter are still occurring on the Tuesday, the last week of Jesus' life before he's arrested and crucified on that Friday. So these things are still taking place on that Tuesday. He's addressing the multitude, beginning in chapter 23 at verse 1, but at verse 13 he begins to directly address the scribes and Pharisees on that occasion. But the multitude that has gathered around him, since he was challenged by some of the religious sects in the previous chapter, are still there, and of course he addresses the multitude. He said in chapter 23 and verse 1, "And then Jesus spoke to the multitude and to his disciples, saying, The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat." Remember, we said that simply has reference to the fact that the scribes and the Pharisees were the teachers of the day. That is, they expounded and taught the law. That's the point that is being made there. And that's actually brought out more in the context as we get on. And so he says, "Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do, but do not do according to their works, for they say and do not do." That is, they're hypocrites, as he will identify them later in the context. Verse 4, "For they bind heavy burdens hard to bear, and they lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers." The point is that they've added a lot to the law of Moses. They bind heavy burdens as if they're tying all of these commands and requirements of God together, but they're commands and requirements of them, the teachers. As they sit in Moses' seat and expound and teach the law of Moses, they're added all of these things to them, and so it's hard to bear, but they'll not move one finger to help the people bear up under the weight of these commands and precepts that they've laid upon the people. "But all of their works they do to be seen by men." And then he describes some of those things that they do to be seen by men. "They make their phylacteries broad, they enlarge the borders of their garments, and they love the best places at the feast, or the uppermost rooms," the King James Version says, "and the best or chief seats in the synagogues." And then in verse 7, where we'll pick up in our comments, verse 7, "They also love the salutations in the marketplace," or the greetings in the marketplaces, "and to be called by men, Rabbi, Rabbi." Yes, they love to be addressed by these terms of high esteem and honor. Especially they love to be addressed by these terms in the marketplace so others could hear, Rabbi, Rabbi. Some versions only put the word rabbi in there once. It's a term that simply means a great one or my great one. It has reference to them being a teacher, my great one. So they love that, to be seen by men and be addressed in such a way as someone great, someone who's a great teacher, you might say. Verse 8, "But you do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher." Now this same word teacher is going to be used later on in the context, but it's used in two different ways here. Here it has reference to a teacher. "But you do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher." What he's going to do is he's going to name several, you might say, titles of honor that the scribes and Pharisees, being teachers of the law, would wear during this particular period of time. These terms that are used here, such as teacher, there's nothing wrong in and of itself with the term teacher. But these scribes and Pharisees had taken terms to identify themselves that lifted themselves up and elevated them beyond the common Jew. That is, they thought they were someone great. As a matter of fact, they wanted the people to think that they were great and highly esteemed and important and superior in knowledge and righteousness to the normal individual. They had displayed that In verse 5, they make their phylacteries broad. Why did they do that? Remember, the phylacteries was a little leather pouch either placed between the eyes on the forehead or on the inside of the left arm. And inside that little leather pouch would be pieces of parchment with scripture wrote on it. And they would make those large. They would enlarge those pouches to hold more scripture. It showed them to be righteous. It showed them to be you might say superior to the common everyday ordinary Jew. And they enlarged the borders of their garment. Of course, it was a requirement to have a border or a hem on the garments required of the old law. But they enlarged theirs. They made theirs broad. They made them to appear to be righteous before the people in a great way. And so they would love the salutations in the marketplace and to be called by men Rabbi or my great one. They simply liked that designation. Verse 8, but you, he's speaking about to the multitude, to the common Jew, do not be called Rabbi, for one is your teacher. Do not be called Rabbi. Now, among the Jews today, that term Rabbi is constantly used. It's still used a lot, but it's used primarily just for the term teacher. And some of the rabbis, of course, they don't wear it as a term to elevate themselves above others, but during this particular period of time, that's what they were doing. They were elevating themselves and showing themselves to be superior to the others among them who also had the law, as if the common Jew, if he had an opportunity to have a copy of one of the prophets, such as the prophet Isaiah, he couldn't read it and understand it like these scribes and Pharisees could. And so because they weren't of the eminent quality of academia, you might say, as these individuals were. And so they love these titles. But you do not be called Rabbi, for one is your teacher, the Christ, and you are all brethren. Now, some versions omit the phrase, the Christ, but Jesus Christ is our teacher. The point is that there is no one superior. There is no one superior to us other than Christ. He's the one from whom we get our instruction. He's the one from whom we get our teaching. And as a matter of fact, all of us do. The preacher is not superior to the members in the congregation. The elders are not superior to the members in the congregation. The deacons are not superior. There's no one superior and over anyone else. Note this, he says you're all brethren. You're all brothers and sisters. You're all equal is the point under consideration. But the scribes and Pharisees did not see themselves equal with the common Jew. They saw themselves to be superior, and that's why they love the titles. Verse 9, do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. Do not call anyone on earth your father. Well, we call our father, father. Is that what Jesus is condemning? No. A father is one who originates something. That is, he is a source of authority. And so they would classify themselves as fathers. That is, doctrine and teaching originated with them. Certain traditions originated with them. They were a source of authority. They saw themselves as a source of authority. And so they would take the title father. If someone wanted to call them father, they would gladly accept that. And that's what's under consideration. It's a religious title that's under consideration, not one being just called a father. As a matter of fact, Paul actually referred to Timothy as his son, which would make Paul his father, but father in a spiritual sense. Not that Paul was superior to him and over him in some way. So it's the religious titles that's under consideration here. And titles of honor to elevate themselves above the common believer in God. So do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. He's the only one with whom the truth originates. He is the one who is the source of authority for all of his teaching, all of his will among mankind. Only God the Father. Verse 10. And do not be called teacher, for one is your teacher, the Christ. Now you see the word here in verse 10, teacher, is the same word translated teacher in verse 8. Now, I think the King James Version uses the word master. I forget which. It might use the word master in both verses, but it's a word for teacher. But it can have reference to a teacher, but it can also have reference, and that's the way I think it's used here, a reference to a guide or a leader, someone who guides people and someone who leads people in the path that they should go. Kind of like a tutor or a guide, one who takes a leadership position. And so he's just not saying the same thing that was said in verse 8. Actually, the word is to be understood in a different way here. If not, he would simply be redundant in his speech, like I am a lot of times, saying the same thing over and over again. Yeah, I know I do that. And do not be called teachers. Well, were they not teachers? Of course they were teachers. Was Christ not referred to as a teacher? Yes. But again, the point under consideration is these scribes and Pharisees had taken on themselves religious titles to show themselves to be superior, or to make those who were underneath them feel as though they were inferior to them in some way, in a knowledge perhaps of the will of God. So do not be called teacher, do not be called a guide, do not be called a leader, do not be called a tutor or a guardian. For one is your teacher, one is your guide, one is your leader, and that is Christ, the Messiah. But he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. So what the scribes and the Pharisees was doing by taking these titles, they were showing themselves to be greater, more important, men of great honor and esteem above the common Jew in Judaism. But he who is greatest among you, the one who is most esteemed among you, the one who is of greatest importance among you, shall be your servant. Same word that's translated deacon in the New Testament. A deacon is a servant. So if these individuals in the multitude, if they want to be someone of high esteem, if they want to be someone of greatness and someone of importance, what do they got to do? Take on a title? No. They're going to have to be servants of one another. They're going to have to serve one another. That's where honor and importance and greatness in the eyes of God comes from. It doesn't come from the wearing of titles to show oneself superior over others. And we understand this in light of the denominational folks who take on religious titles and show themselves to be superior to others, like the Catholics refer to their priest as father, and like the Jehovah's Witness have apostles. And so they've taken on titles to show themselves to be superior to others in some way. And the scriptures clearly condemn that. But I want to suggest to you that we're seeing more and more of it in the church today. I'm talking about in the Church of Christ. Because people will go to schools, religious institutions, and they'll get a doctor's degree. And the first thing you know is an announcement that there's going to be a gospel meeting. And you see that Dr. So-and-so is going to be the speaker. Why put that on there? Why put that on there except to show, well, he's a very learned man? Is it put on there to show that he has a superior knowledge to someone who did not go to some institution of learning and get that kind of degree? And so that's what Jesus is condemning here, the superiority. There's nothing wrong with going to a school of higher education and getting that those initials before your name. Nothing wrong whatsoever. And there's nothing wrong with calling them doctor. But if the point is to make themselves to appear superior in the eyes of others, they're doing the same thing that the scribes and Pharisees were doing at this time. And so we need to be careful about that. Need to be careful about that indeed. But he continues with that thought, because these scribes and Pharisees, they had exalted themselves. They had lifted themselves up. They had elevated themselves in the eyes of the people because they were filled with haughtiness and pride. And so he says, in the very next verse, he says, "And whoever exalts himself will be humbled." He'll be put down. He'll be brought low. Who's going to bring him down? Who's going to put him down? Who's going to put him in his place? God is. When one takes on an air of superiority, when one takes on an air of haughtiness and arrogance above others and lifts himself up above others in superiority, God will bring him down. Remember, pride is a cause of many a fall. And so whoever exalts himself will be humbled. But note this, goes back to the previous verse, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. He'll be lifted up. He'll be lifted up to heaven. He'll be lifted up in the eyes of God because he is a servant. He humbles himself. He doesn't show himself in the eyes of men to be superior and over someone else. He serves them. He serves them and humbles himself. And God will exalt that one with such an attitude or disposition. Questions or comments where we're at? Verse 13, he begins to address specifically now. He was addressing the multitude. He begins to address specifically now the scribes and Pharisees who've been standing and listening to this. And he begins with this little word, woe, but woe to you. Woe is an interjection. Used in two primary ways in the New Testament. First, in the sense of woe in regard to grief or sorrow or displeasure. But here it's used, woe, you scribes and Pharisees. It's used in this, as an interjection for condemnation, a denouncement. And that's what's being spoken here by the simple little word, woe. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees. Hypocrites. So he describes them by that word. Play actors, stage actors. That's how the word was originally used in the Greeks for those who would put on a mask and play on the stage. They would pretend to be someone else. So he has identified them and some of their characteristics in the verses previous to this. And that's exactly what they are. They're hypocrites. They pretend to be righteous. Oh, they show a great air of superiority and righteousness above the regular Jew. But they're pretending. It's a false appearance. They're hypocrites. Note this, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. For you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. You shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. You shut up the kingdom of heaven. That is, they preclude men from entering the kingdom of heaven. They keep men from entering the kingdom of heaven. They hinder men from entering the kingdom of heaven. Now, how do they shut up the kingdom of heaven? By their teaching. That's how they do it, by their teaching. By their teaching and by their influence. Because he's going to go on to show that, you know, he had said in regard to this earlier, he said, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do, remember, because they're teachers and expounders of the law. But do not do according to their works, for they say and do not. They might teach what is right, but they're going to add a lot of commandments and precepts and traditions of men, which God never intended them to add. And they're going to hinder and prevent men from entering the kingdom of heaven by doing that. And through their influence, they're going to do the same thing. For you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. In what way? Well, he'll tell us in verse 15. Because verse 13 is connected with verse 15. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he is won, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourself. So what happened to verse 14? Well, in some versions, it's omitted. It's not in there. Some Greek texts have it. Some Greek texts don't have it. And it seems to be, having been inserted, maybe from Mark's account or Luke's account, we don't know, but perhaps it may have been supposed to be there. But nonetheless, it may have just been copied out of place. It's still true. It may have, the one who copied the text, he may have simply copied verse 14 when he was supposed to be copying verse 15. Perhaps verse 14 may was supposed to come after verse 15. So to say that it wasn't supposed to be in the text at all, we don't know. It could have been a copier's error. You know, some scribe who were copying the text. So when we go from verse 13 to verse 15, though, we see how it is that nor do you allow those who are entering in to go in. Because in Judaism, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, verse 15 again, hypocrites, for you travel land and sea to win one proselyte. You travel land and sea. Literally, land and sea. But the point is that they'll go to a great extent. That's the point. As we would say today, well, I'd travel around the world, or I'd travel this far, I would do this, or I would do that. They travel land and sea. They don't go to a great extent to win one proselyte. That is to win one proselyte to Judaism. Now, a proselyte is simply a foreigner. It's someone who's not a Jew originally, a Gentile. But if they could win them to Judaism, they had done something. It was a big deal to them. Proselytes, there were two kinds of proselytes to Judaism. Some were referred to as proselytes of the gate. That is, those Gentiles who would accept Judaism to a certain degree or to a certain point. But they would not undergo circumcision and keep some of their, you might say, the finer or most important points of the law of Moses. And so they'd be referred to as proselytes of the gate. Then there were those who would be referred to as proselytes of righteousness. This is Gentiles who would completely abandon paganism and completely accept Judaism and even go to the point of being circumcised in order to become a Jew outwardly. Those were proselytes of righteousness. And so the scribes and Pharisees, they would do everything they could to win one proselyte to Judaism. But when they had won that Gentile to Judaism, that Gentile simply becomes twice as much a son of hell as the scribes and Pharisees because of the influence of the scribes and Pharisees. Because, see, they taught the law of Moses, but they didn't perform the law of Moses. They didn't faithfully keep the law of Moses. And so they would make this proselyte... Okay, they've won him to Judaism, but he becomes twice as bad as they are. This phrase, son of hell here, is a Hebrewism. Simply means a son who's subject to hell. Hell here is Gehenna. That is, he is subject to being punished in hell. Just as these individuals are subject to being punished in hell. They make them... twice as much a son of hell as you yourselves. So the scribes and Pharisees are subject to being punished in eternal torment. Go back to verse 14 now. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers. Therefore you will receive greater condemnation or greater punishment. You devour widows' houses. Devour here means to gobble down, to swallow down. But it's used here metaphorically or figuratively to refer to plundering or stealing, taking from the widows what rightfully belongs to them. The scribes during this particular period of time were those, remember, who were skilled in the law of Moses. And usually one in Judaism would, a husband would make arrangements like we do today in case we die, that our widow will be taken care of and the children will be taken care of in a will. Well, what the scribes would do, they would actually do this for a fee, is that will, the scribes would be the executor of it. And what would they do? They would cheat the widows and the children out of that which rightfully belongs to them. And that's the ideal of them devouring widows' houses. They simply rob the widows. They simply take that which should belong to them, but they confiscate it for themselves. They execute and carry out the will, but the way they want to. Now, if you remember Jewish law, remember there was a provision set aside in the Jewish law for widows to be taken care of and their property. Remember, if a brother died and he had another brother, that brother was to marry his wife in order to raise up children, in order for that property to remain with them, and in order for there to be an heir to the property. So there were things that had to be taken care of, but what they would do is they would simply rob the widows. So you devour widows' houses. And there's a great deal in the Scriptures, Old Testament and New Testament as well, taking care of the widows and the orphans. But these scribes and Pharisees, they showed no mercy. They showed no mercy, no compassion, no pity. They didn't care if a widow's, if all of her property, houses here doesn't just mean houses, it means property, has reference to property, everything that she owns, they would just simply take away from. And for a pretense, that is for a show, they make long prayers. For a pretense or for a show, they make long. There's nothing wrong with long prayers. Long prayers are not condemned in the Scripture. This passage is not condemning long prayers. What is being condemned in this is long prayers for a pretense or for a show. One writer said, during this particular period of time, and even 200 AD, Jews would meditate or pray for an hour. Meditate for an hour and then pray another hour in public. For 3 hours they would do that. Long prayers for pretense. That is to be seen of men. That's why they were doing it. To be seen of men. So it's not the long prayers that's a problem. It's the attitude and disposition of the heart of the one doing the praying that's the problem. They simply do this to be seen of men, to be elevated in the eyes of men. So it goes back in the context earlier of what we have seen. Therefore, that is because of these two things just mentioned in this, the devouring of widow's house and for a pretense making long prayers, therefore you will receive greater condemnation. You'll receive greater punishment. Brother Little asked one time, it's been several meetings back, if there were degrees of punishment. Well, here's one place in the Scripture where you'll receive greater condemnation. Condemnation here is greater damnation or punishment. That is, they know better than this. They have no mercy. They have no kindness, no pity, no compassion shown to the widows. And they above all people, being teachers of the law, will receive greater condemnation. And that's why James, in James chapter 2, tells us that don't let many, even Christians, become teachers. Why? Because teachers are held to a stricter standard. That is, they should know better than others, and they'll be punished with severe punishment. Verse 16, woe to you, blind guides, who say, whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obligated to perform it. Woe to you, blind guides. Were these people blind? They were standing there looking at Jesus. They weren't blind physically, but they were blind mentally. That's what's under consideration here. They were blind mentally. He shows how they're blind mentally here, because he's going to use some terms that show them to be foolish, that shows them to be stupid, that shows them to be ignorant, based upon their reasoning, based upon their logic. So from verse 16, and this will go all the way through verse 22, we have several things mentioned about vows. That is, promises that are made. That is, one makes a vow or swears. And so this is what the scribes and Pharisees were teaching here. But this shows the foolishness, the ignorance, and their stupidity. And that's why it calls them blind guides. They should be guiding others in the way of truth, but they can't. They're blind. They can't even guide themselves because they're mentally blind. Whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing. That is, the temple standing in Jerusalem. Nas, that's the word here. Whoever swears by the temple, that is, makes a vow or makes a promise. I swear by the temple to do this or that. I swear by the temple that I'll pay you $50 next week. That's nothing, they say. That means you don't have to keep that vow. It's all right to break that vow if you just swear by the temple. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he's obligated to perform it. Now, I forget, the King James Version used some other word than obligated. Forget what it is. Debtor. He's a debtor to keep it. That is, he's obligated to keep it. So he's obligated to keep the vow then if he swears by the gold of the temple. But if he just swears by the temple, he's not obligated to keep it. Now, note Jesus' logic here and reasoning. He says, fools and blind. Fools here. Fools. The word translated fools here is the word from which we get our English word moron. One who is stupid, one who is ignorant, one who has lack of understanding. Fools and blind, mentally blind again. For which is greater, Jesus asked, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? Yes, the temple sanctifies the gold. It consecrates it, sets it apart, devotes it to the service of God. The temple does. Now you see where they put their emphasis? They put their emphasis on gold. They don't put their emphasis on that which belongs to God, the temple itself. But their emphasis is upon the gold that perhaps is used in the decoration of the temple, or perhaps it may be even in the temple treasury. But their emphasis is upon the gold. So what's the answer to that? For which is greater? Which is more important? The gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? What's the answer? Which one's more important? The temple or the gold? The temple is. It's the house of God. It's the dwelling place of God in the Spirit. But you see, they see the gold as more important. That's why the scribes and the Pharisees said, if you vow by the gold that's in the temple, you got to keep that vow. You're obligated to keep that promise. But let's look at the foolishness of their reasoning as we continue. And whoever swears by the altar. You see, they had all of these rules and regulations. If you swear this way or swear that way, swear this way or swear that way. If you swear by the altar that is under consideration is the altar of burnt sacrifice. That is just before the door of the temple. So whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing. That's what the scribes and Pharisees say. If you swear by the altar, it's nothing. That is, you have no obligation to keep that vow. You have no obligation to keep that promise. But whoever swears by the gift that is on it, that is, by the offering that is on it, by the sacrifice that is on it, he is obligated to perform it. I think the King James Version uses the word guilty there. He's guilty. He has a debt to keep that obligation. That he has a debt to keep that promise. So Jesus asked again, fools and blind, fools. Those of you who are stupid, those of you who are ignorant, those of you who lack understanding, those of you who are mentally blind, because they think their reasoning is great. But Jesus shows it to be utter folly and foolishness. For which is greater, that is, which is more important, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Oh, they think the gift is greater. That is, that which they bring and lay on the altar. They think that which they bring and put on the altar is of more importance than the altar itself. But that which is placed on the altar wouldn't even be there if it wasn't for the altar itself. The important thing is the altar. That's the point Jesus is making. Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it. If you swear by the altar, you swear by everything that's on it. You can't separate those two things. Because just as the temple sanctifies, sets apart, and consecrates the gold in service to God, so does the altar sanctify, set apart, and consecrate the sacrifice that is on the altar. One can't be separated from the other. Verse 21, he who swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. If one swears by the temple, you're also swearing by the one who dwells in it. You can't separate. Now, who is the one who dwells in it? We just studied this on Sunday. The temple. Who dwells in the temple? God dwells in the temple. He dwells in the temple. So you can't separate a vow that you say, I swear by the temple. You can't separate that vow from a vow that says, I swear by God. Verse 22, and he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it. Jesus is not speaking of himself here, he's speaking of God. You see, the scribes and Pharisees, they had made rules and regulations where God had made none. Their logic, their reasoning was simply foolishness. And that's why he referred to them as blind guides. They should have been guiding the people in the truth, but they were blind. They were mentally blind and could not see the truth. They could not see the folly and the stupidity of their own reasoning and their own logic. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it. God is seated on the throne. All right, we're out of time. Good place to stop. Questions are coming. We'll pick up here at Matthew 23 and verse 23 next Wednesday evening. Thank you very much for your kind attention this evening.